John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Good evening. Ukraine crisis, NATO crisis. Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus, joins to comment on the weeks and days events in the conflict that began in a civil war in Ukraine and is now expanded to a threat across the Russian frontier, focused now on the Baltic state area because the Secretary of Defense of the United States of America, Ashton Carter, traveling to the Baltic to meet with other NATO officials, but on a warship in the Baltic, the San Antonio, addressing U.S. military personnel in these last hours, followed through on a rumor of a week past that Professor Cohen and I spoke of the U.S. prepositioning heavy weaponry, enough for a brigade of 3,000 to 5,000 along the Russian frontier, pre-positioning. And we will listen to Ashton Carter and his mention of what kinds of weapons and how extensive this pre-positioning can be.
American rotational forces need to move more quickly and easily to participate in training and exercises here. That's why I'm pleased to announce, and I discussed with my colleagues earlier today, that we will temporarily stage one armored brigade combat team's vehicles and associated equipment in countries in Central and Eastern Europe. This pre-positioned European activity set includes tanks, infantry fighting vehicles, and artillery. Estonia, as well as Lithuania, Latvia, Bulgaria, Romania, and Poland, have agreed to host company to battalion-sized elements of this equipment, which will be moved around the region for training and exercises.
In anticipation of the announcement by the Secretary of Defense, Sergei Ivanov, who is the chief of staff of President Vladimir Putin of Russia, told the Financial Times prior to this announcement that the relations between the United States and Russia are deteriorating to the extent that he says the rhetoric has started to go off the scale. That's a quote. He also said any drastic move by NATO, in especially prepositioning weaponry, would be answered by Russia concentrating its focus. No explanation. I mentioned that within these same days, the European Union decided to extend its sanctions on Russia because of Ukraine crisis an additional 6 months. There were phone calls, there were sharp words exchanged between European leaders, especially Angela Merkel of Germany, and Vladimir Putin. But in any event, the sanctions have been extended. However, that is not all the news from the region. I add especially that there is reason to believe that in Ukraine itself, there is now additional pressure on the President Poroshenko to relaunch the offensive against the Donbass. Within these last hours, this is reporting from the special monitoring mission by the OSCE that is charged with following the terms of the ceasefire worked out in February of this year, the so-called Minsk II terms of a ceasefire along the front line, has been following the exchange of gunfire. This has been routine for these last months, but especially, I note, between a period of about 12 hours in the Donetsk airport area, where the fighting was most fierce before it ended, there was an exchange observed of 362 explosions, consistent, says the OSCE, with artillery and mortar fire, as well as bursts with automatic grenade launchers, heavy machine guns, small arms, and light weapons fire. I could go on with the OSCE reporting to say that across the Donbass, from the Donetsk to the Luhansk to the Mariupol front, we're seeing exchanges, deaths. There were two Ukrainian soldiers removed by the OSCE team. I end with the fact that there was a protest in Kiev within these last days by those identified with the right sector. These are the National Guard units, some of which were trained by the United States Airborne Brigade in its exercises these last weeks, demanding that the offensive in Donbass be relaunched. Minsk II, which was waiting for the sanctions decision in European Union, is now hanging in the balance. And to that end, President Putin at the Petersburg International Economic Forum these last days, he spoke to American television, he spoke to Charlie Rose, made remarks consistent with the fact that he's gloomy. He's discouraged by the developments, and the quotes point to Mr. Putin having to respond. He said, "We are not aggressive. We are persistent in pursuing our interests. I'll end there and turn to the professor to begin with the NATO crisis. Steve, what began in Ukraine in the winter of 2014 is now all along the Russian frontier. It is not just a new Cold War. It is actively arming for a conflict. And again, I say good evening to you, Steve.
Where do we begin? Let's begin with the possible end. You played the tape of the new American Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter, announcing that a great many heavy weapons of war will be moved to countries on Russia's borders. And I assure you, John, this is only the beginning. What's happening now is what a group within NATO have wanted for 15 years, permanent military bases right plunk on Russia's borders. That's the three Baltic states, but also in Poland. Carter made this announcement, and you remember last week, John, we talked about a report in the Times that this could happen. But we now know the decision had already been made. That leak story to the Times was to prepare us for this very radical, I would say reckless, act of escalation on the part of the United States and NATO. Carter read it as though he were a vice president of General Motors describing a new model of the Ford or something, or whoever makes Ford, a new car. But it's flirting with apocalypse. It's literally flirting with war with Russia. And since both sides are doing the tit-for-tat game, one does something, the other reacts, they've even introduced talk of nuclear weapons. The newspapers, in reporting this, get it a little wrong. They say that this is the first time since the end of the Cold War that the United States and NATO have moved heavy military equipment to Russia's borders. That's imprecise. This is the first time in history. It's never happened before. During the Cold War, the troops on Russia's borders were Russian allied troops, the Warsaw Pact. Now, America's moving its troops, NATO troops, where Russia's troops used to be, on its own defense perimeter. The Russians have said, but they didn't have to say it for us to know it, that they must now react. And I say must because there's a politics in Moscow. Putin doesn't have the option of just shrugging his shoulders and saying, oh, what the heck do, you know, 5,000 Western soldiers and all these tanks and armored vehicles matter. He has to do something, and we can discuss what they might do. But when he does that something, Washington and NATO will now feel they have to react. So what has happened with this decision is an escalation of the new Cold War in the direction of a hot war with Russia. And it's being done under entirely false pretexts. Just read the massive anti-Russian propaganda campaign. And I use the word propaganda in the sense not of information, but of false information. The massive propaganda campaign of the last week or so saying that somehow Putin's Russia is on the move again in an aggressive way, and that poses an immediate threat to the three tiny Baltic countries. This is a lie. This is false. There's not a word of truth in this. This is being done and manipulated by people in the West who have wanted to do this for decades, to make a move on Russia. The only question, two questions in my mind, are, one, do these people, and this is the victory of the war party and the defeat of the diplomatic party, the one that defended Minsk that you and I have discussed. This is a great victory of the war party. Do these people actually want and seek a military showdown with Putin's Russia? Do they actually want some kind of war in Ukraine, in the Baltics, inside Russia, somewhere? If they don't, there's no rational explanation for what they're doing. And the other question is, to paraphrase the Russian poet Pushkin, why is the American political elite silent? Why is not one voice in our political elite being raised to say, stop, don't do this. This is reckless. You are headed toward war. It's a mystery of the present that maybe history will answer.
Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, Russian history. I mentioned that Steve Cohen is a member of the founding board of the America Committee for East-West Accord. You can read news about the conflict and the exasperation of people watching this from the history of the first Cold War to the new Cold War at eastwestaccord.com. When we come back, the voices of the Baltic and an opinion by the defense minister of Estonia about Putin's tactics. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University is here. Also, the American Committee for East-West Accord at eastwestaccord.com. You can see summaries of the conflict. We're about to hear the defense minister of Estonia speaking in the same event where Ashton Carter, the Secretary of Defense of the United States, announced pre-positioning heavy weapons along the Russian frontier that the professor points out never happened in the Cold War because of the Warsaw Pact, all of those buffer states that Stalin chewed off at the end of the Second War when he overran the Hitlerites. We're going to hear Sven Mikser comment on what the Baltic states believe is Putin's tactic.
We are not talking about entering into a new Cold War type of arms race. We are not trying collectively to match Putin, tank by tank or helicopter by helicopter in the Baltic Sea region either. But the problem is that Putin sees himself as having two advantages, one of space, the other of time. Basically, he believes that he can move things very quickly, he can do things very quickly because he... It's a very Putin-centric autocratic system, and he can take decisions and start implementing them immediately. And secondly, because of the geographic proximity, he has quite significant assets here that are immediately on the other side of the border.
There it is, Steve, the paranoia. They believe Putin's coming.
Well, we all know the expression, the tail wags the dog. The dog being the United States and secondarily NATO. The most powerful military alliance in the world and perhaps ever known in history. And the three tiny little Baltic states are crying wolf. They're crying wolf because they have legitimate grievances against Russia that go back in history. Mexico has legitimate grievances, I guess, against the United States, but they're not mobilizing an army to attack us or calling on allies to defend them. The reality is that the Baltics want to be important. The political elites do. How important, how popular this is with the actual citizens of the Baltic countries is another question. Not sure they've done any polling about this. But the political elites of these tiny countries want to be important. They want to be important in the sense that they want to be the priority of NATO. And so they argue every day that they see new signs that Putin is mobilizing, that he's got the advantages of space. Of course he does. They share a border with him. This is not Putin's fault. That he's somehow preparing to attack them. There is not a shred of evidence for this. There is not a bit of empirical evidence. It's either historical paranoia, it's ideology, or it's the politics of elites, not only in the Baltic countries, but also in Poland, for example, that want to be more important in world politics than their size and location and capacity makes them. And so they are, I don't know if they're manipulating or they're giving the war party in Washington and in Brussels what it wants. But on the pretext, and remember, it's no longer, you pointed this out at the beginning, it's interesting. It's no longer Ukraine that's being defended here. Ash Carter never mentioned anything about Putin being aggressive in Ukraine. And this defense minister of Estonia doesn't mention Ukraine. And by the way, the defense of Ukraine is no longer, according to polls, very popular in Poland. Polish people seem to think it's gotten Poland into a mess. This is about NATO, expanding NATO. Let's be clear again. This is unprecedented in history. Never before has American military might been planted physically on Russia's borders. Never before. It's true there was a small American expeditionary intervention in the Russian Civil War in 1918, 1919. But that was something completely different. These people are building permanent American NATO garrison and bases along Russia's borders. If your folks who listen can't imagine this, let's take the cliche. We wake up to tomorrow, and China has massive garrisons on the Canadian and Mexican border. That's the equivalent. Russia will now react. And the way Russia reacts will determine the way we react, and those two reactions will, if this continues, take us closer to war. I repeat, this is done on false pretexts, it's unprecedented, and it's exceedingly reckless. If the Baltics want to be safe, living in the shadow of Russia, all they have to do is negotiate with Russia, one issue being that these countries need to treat their Russian-speaking minorities more fairly and not disenfranchise them. But Russia is not going to attack the Baltic question states for this reason. Putin said to a Italian newspaper about a week ago, it would be the nightmare of a completely sane man to invade the Baltics, I mean, how much stronger can he be in denying it? But the problem is that Putin has been so vilified, so demonized, so caricatured in the West that nothing he says is even heard.
Well, you heard the defense minister be dismissive and disdainful and condemnatory of the president of Russia in those remarks. Based on no aggression, to my reading, Steve, I just look up the news, no aggression by Russia against Estonia. No one crossing the frontier, no armed camp across the border. These are historical feuds, right, Steve? This has to do with the Soviet era and the fact that this younger man...
Well, they say that, John. They say that. That the Baltics say, look how badly we were treated
right
by the Russians after World War II. And it's true. They were occupied.
Wait,
but
just
they
a moment.
They were also part of the Tsarist Empire.
We'll go to the St. Petersburg Economic Forum when we come back, Steve, because we'll grow this story. It happened in the Baltic Sea Basin, and so it's best to bring St. Petersburg and Vladimir Putin and his comments to American television in. Steve Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, Russian History. I'm John Batchelor. John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Professor Cohen is here, and we're discussing Ukraine crisis is where we started, but it's now NATO crisis. We're going to get to Ukraine tonight because there's reason to believe that President Poroshenko has lost control of his militarist state, and that there are threats in Kiev that should be taken seriously. Certainly, there's conduct along the Donbass frontier now that Minsk II is abandoned or elbowed aside or ignored by everyone but Vladimir Putin, including the fact that Minsk II is all they've got to settle the Ukraine civil war. But we have to go to the St. Petersburg Economic Forum that happens every year. Vladimir Putin attended, and so did significant members of the European media and the presence of one man, Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras. Steve, we were discussing the Baltic states and their anxiety about Vladimir Putin being aggressive. But now we have a troubled European state, member of NATO and member of the European Union, member of the Euro, that's Greece, that is pleading for mercy from the European Union, especially from the Germans, and not getting it to the terms of a bailout or extending its needs because the austerity has beggared the country, driven the young people out of the country to find work. But in any event, Prime Minister Tsipras was in St. Petersburg and prominently pictured with Vladimir Putin. This looks like Putin's response to the European bullying going on over Ukraine crisis. Is it, Steve?
Well, let's context this and let's link it to the military escalation that was announced today and we've just discussed. Let's go to what has been President Obama's political policy toward Putin since the crisis began. He said it on a number of occasions. Our policy is to isolate Putin's Russia. Isolate. Now, that policy has substantially failed in terms of finance, loans, political relations, investment. Russia's been hurt, isolated by the sanctions, but not completely isolated. It's turned to China. It's turned to the BRICS country. It's managing. So then comes this annual Russian Davos, as it's called, this grand conference of business and corporate executives who come to St. Petersburg, Putin hosts. What did it show? Was Putin isolated or was he not isolated? Well, in a way, it showed both. For example, the State Department warned American business executives not to go, but I think about 15 or 20 important ones showed up and did go. That is, they defied the White House. Quite a few European executives went. And not only that, something I think unnoticed, they signed an agreement in St. Petersburg with Gazprom, the giant Russian oil and gas company, to complete another leg of a pipeline carrying Russian natural gas to Europe. That pipeline, that leg, that last leg of the second pipeline will in effect, and we'll come to Greece in a moment, come close to eliminating Ukraine as an essential supply route from Russia to Europe for natural gas. That's been Ukraine's one card to play against Russia. But obviously these people did the opposite in signing this agreement with Gazprom. They didn't isolate Putin, they integrated his oil and gas companies into the European economy. So now we come to Greece. Well, we understand that the Greek government is playing a very high-stakes political game. They want relief from the EU, from Merkel. And it appears, unless some deal is struck today, they're not getting it. So they are saying, and this is not the prime minister's first trip to Russia, I think it's his third, well, we have an alternative. We can turn to Russia. Now, remember, to keep the sanctions on Russia, every European Union country has to vote yes. If one votes no, the sanctions are off. Greece voted to continue the sanctions, but only till December. So potentially, Greece could put an end to the European sanctions, not the American ones. So Greece has cards to play. And what is it that Russia wants from Greece? Because the easiest thing for Putin to do to help Greece right now would be to unilaterally end the Russian ban on European agricultural produce to Russia, because Greece is being banned and it's being hurt. And Putin could say, okay, we're going to exempt you. But he's holding out for something much more, and that's this third pipeline that bypasses Ukraine that goes to Turkey. And for that, Putin wants Greece to play a role, to get a terminal. Now, the terminal, excuse me, John, the terminal is worth money to Greece. I don't know exactly how much, but probably about $800 million in transit fees a year. That's a lot more than the IMF or the European Union is giving Greece at the moment. It is said, but we haven't seen the document, that Greece signed an agreement of intent to participate in that pipeline with Russia. So that's sort of geo-economic politics at the very highest level. Putin said about a month ago that it is the Russian goal to completely eliminate the transit of Russian energy through Ukraine, which, by the way, is a legacy of the Soviet Union, because that's where the Soviet Union built the Western-bound pipelines, to eliminate the transit of all energy across Ukraine by 2019. The Greeks could help make that happen.
The concern here, Steve, is this romance between Russia and Europe and the long-standing marriage, you'd have to say, partnership between Europe and the United States. therein is where I see, I'm trying to think macro here, Steve, where I think I see the tension. And Russia is seeking to persuade Europe that its future is eastward regarding Russian energy, Russian development, and Russia's alliance now with China and with other Asian states. The United States is comfortable being the boss, the leader, and as we see with Ashton Carter, the arsenal of democracy for Europe. And Greece might be the first instance we could seize upon that it's thinking about what's in it for us. And they're looking to go in, they could go either way. And that never would have happened in the new Cold War, would have been impossible for Athens to imagine alliance with Russia after all the troubles Harry Truman's administration and the Brits went through after the Second War, loosening Greece from the communist overrun. So here we are in the new Cold War, and Greece is probably not alone, Steve. We have the little country Estonia and the Baltic states, but I can imagine there are other countries, we spoke of Italy last week, that are looking about what's in it for us, and they're looking at Washington and they're looking at Moscow, and they're persuaded that Moscow has something to offer.
Well, it's a given that economic interest weighs heavily on political policy. And the Western and Southern countries of Europe have been hurt very, very badly by the sanctions. Not only have the Western sanctions cut them off from their investments in Russia, there are 6,000 plus German medium-sized countries operating in Russia, 6,000. It's billions and billions of dollars a year, plus a lot of employment. That all hangs in the balance. So it's not surprising that half of Germany wants these sanctions ended. Same's true in Italy. Same's true in Cyprus. All of these countries are members of the European Union, and it requires a unanimous vote to maintain the sanctions. But here's something of a kind of puzzle, John. All of these countries that pursue the hardest line toward Russia, that are clamoring for American weapons on their borders, countries that wouldn't mind a fight, military fight, between the United States and Russia, these countries, Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, Poland, Bulgaria,
Romania,
all of these countries are close to 100% dependent on Russian energy. 100%, nearly. The question is, why Russia doesn't just turn the spigot off? Why Russia doesn't say, fine, you are now at war with us. We do not give energy to our military enemies. Go find some way to warm your homes and light your lights someplace else, and they cannot. Why does Russia not do this? Because I assure you there are people in Moscow who are saying to Putin exactly what I said to you just now. Look, Volodya, this is war. Look at the American troops coming. There are 6,000 American and NATO troops roaming around the countrysides on our borders already, even before these heavy weapons come. They've been there for weeks. There are NATO and American ships in our seas. We are on the eve of war. You don't supply your enemy with energy. Cut them off. And Putin doesn't do it. What are the reasons, do you think, John?
The reason it has to do with persuasion. You can't kick them to you. And so if Putin has the card, Steve, there's no reason for him to be abrupt. He can wait for the European states to weaken towards his case, which is that the future is to grow east. The U.S. cannot supply energy to any of those states, France, England, or the Eastern Europeans. We can't supply the money. We can't rescue the euro. All we can do is rattle the guns, right, Steve? All we can do is, let's say, encourage the thinking that Putin is coming, Putin is coming. And isn't that what we're seeing in the Baltic states right now?
We are, but what I'm asking myself, and you kind of rhetorically, because if I haven't figured it out and I study Moscow every day, I doubt that you figured it out, but there are some hypothetical answers that anybody might figure out. One side says to Putin, more or less what you say, John, look, you hold the cards, eventually Europe will come around. keep playing the diplomatic card. Keep calling the Americans our partners, as he did every day of the week in St. Petersburg and in his interview with Charlie Rose. Our American partners made a mistake. Our American partners didn't act honorably. Our American partners. We're not his partners. We're now his enemies. So what does the other side say to him in this Kremlin debate? They say, Mr. President, fight today with energy or fight tomorrow with weapons in Crimea. In other words, the Americans and NATO aren't going to stop in the Baltics. If you think they're just going to put these bases in the Baltics and then quit, no, no. The next stop is they will be in Ukraine.
All right, let's go
remember,
to Ukraine.
Just to end, there are already, we don't know how many, American boots on the ground in Ukraine.
We're going to go to Ukraine. You remind me, Steve, I just read it the other day, Will Rogers' definition of diplomacy. Long ago, this is during the crisis in Europe in the 1930s, he defined it as, it's saying good doggy until you can find a rock. So when we come back, we'll discuss diplomacy in Ukraine in the 21st century. With Steve Cohen, Professor Steve Cohen, New York University, Russian History at Princeton University, Russian History. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Professor Cohen is here. We're discussing Ukraine crisis now. We've spent our time with NATO crisis, which is overwhelming. Ashton Carter's statement, and I correct myself, the sunspot. Ashton Carter was in the Baltics, a state in the Baltic Sea on the San Antonio addressing U.S. troops. He was also in Tallinn, the capital of Estonia. And that is where he made the statement that you heard at the top of the show, along with the Estonian defense minister. Although the sentiment was long in the news since the leak in the New York Times. Now we go to Ukraine because there is a report that the right sector has decided that Poroshenko is not going to launch the attack in Donbass, that they're going to launch it on their own. They've been trained. They've been equipped. There is evidence from the OSCE that very few weapons have been pulled back. It's a show. They switch them at night. They deny the OSCE. That's the monitoring of Minsk II, handled by the OSCE and very brave people. The special monitoring mission, they use UAVs. They interview people. They go to the same places every day and see if they can get access. And the Ukrainian forces and the separatist forces can deny them access to restricted zones. So they can only do a guessing game of what weapons have been pulled back and what are at the frontier. But within these last hours, there's plenty of evidence that the weapons have returned to launch offensives, if that's necessary, if that's going to happen. And Steve, Vladimir Putin's remarks in Petersburg, it's impossible to tell at this remove whether Putin believes that Kiev is going to launch an offensive in Donbass. However, I recall several months ago information I had that there are voices in the Kremlin, these are the militarists, saying the next time they double-cross us, President Putin, go to Kiev. Is that possible, Steve?
No, they won't go to Kiev. They'll go to Mariupol. They'll take the whole of Donbass and possibly to Odessa. Remember, we've talked about this before. The Donbass rebels, who call themselves variously the Army of the Donbass or the New Russian Army, Novaya Russia Armia, in fact, don't control large parts of the Donbass. So their political goal, so to speak, their legitimacy to control the equivalent of the entire Confederacy, let us say, would require them taking Mariupol. So if there is a new offensive, two things will happen. The Ukrainian army and its ultra battalions will once again suffer a grievous loss. And this time, it's possible that the rebel army will not stop at the demarcation line. It will keep going to Mariupol. But something's happening in Kiev. And you wonder if whether or not this escalation militarily in the Baltic region is the West's compensation for what seems to be the failed Western policy in Kiev. There have been some very strange developments. Poroshenko, the president, seems to make contradictory statements daily. One day he says he supports negotiations, the Minsk agreement, and the next day he says he's going to retake Crimea and the Donbass by force. Now, the ultra battalions, some people call them neo-fascist, the best known being Right Sector, says that on July 3rd, which is, what, a couple weeks away, it's going to march on Kiev and demand that Poroshenko resume the military assault on eastern Ukraine. And if he doesn't do that, it's going to overthrow him. At about the same time, Poroshenko does outwardly the strangest of things. The president of Ukraine, he appeals to the Ukrainian Constitutional Court to rule that the overthrow of his predecessor, President Yanukovych, was unconstitutional. Now, how do those pieces fit? People such as myself and other critics of American policy have said that the elected president in February 2014 was illegally overthrown, and that the new government, which the United States backed, had no legitimacy. And that's been the standard Western policy for more than a year, that it has full legitimacy, that he wasn't overthrown, that it was a revolution. But now the president of Ukraine, whom we support, Poroshenko, is asking the Supreme Court to say that his predecessor was thrown out of office illegally. Why would he do that? And the only answer I can think of, and it's a speculation, is that Poroshenko, the current president, now himself fears that he may be overthrown. And he wants it established in Ukrainian law that you're not allowed to do that, that you're not allowed to overthrow an elected president, even though he had no problems when his predecessor was overthrown. If this is a correct speculation on my part, it means that Poroshenko is deathly fearful
yes.
of these threats by Right Sector and others, that they're going to march on Kiev. Now, bear in mind who these people are. We're not allowed in official establishment discourse in America to call them neo-fascist, but a great many of them are just that. And these people are now calling for a second Maidan revolution in Ukraine, not a democratic one of a different kind. So it could be, and leave aside, you know, the already melted down Ukrainian economy, that the regime in Kiev is melting down.
We have 30 seconds, Dave.
The worst thing from my point of view, on a personal level, though, is the call now, the demand, including by Americans who support Kiev, that it completely blockade the people in eastern Ukraine, essentially to starve them to death,
right,
to let more of them die. This is so inhumane that for Americans to call for this policy shows how debased we, the United States, have become by this Ukrainian crisis. We are supporting a regime that's committed war crimes against innocent civilians in the East. And now many of the people, these same people, are now asking for a form of genocide or ethnic cleansing in eastern Ukraine by the government we support in Kiev.
Professor,
this is shameful.
Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus, also the American Committee for East-West Accord, that's EastWestAccord.com. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show.